And now WDEV FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us this morning. And welcome to San Diego, or at least it feels like San Diego this morning as we sit here in Waterbury, Vermont. The fog, the temp, just the weather is just unbelievable. Got a full program for you today. First off, we'll open up the phone lines and take your calls on any issues or things that you think are important this morning. And then we'll speak with Matt Cota, Vermont Field Dealers Association. He's with the Vermont Field Dealers Association. And our topic today is the carbon tax. A lot of politicians are talking about the carbon tax, so I wanted to bring in Matt Cota from the Vermont Field Dealers Association to talk about it from his perspective. And then we'll talk with a favorite here at WDEV, former Governor Jim Douglas, and he'll be in studio to talk about this time of year when you're on the fifth floor. We talked a little bit about it with Liz Miller yesterday, but want to get the governor's perspective on what it's like this time of year. Very, very busy time on the fifth floor this time of year, and also talk to him about other state issues and what he is doing now. And I just want to give a little bit of a prep for tomorrow. A large portion of tomorrow's program will be on your phone, will be with phone calls, your phone calls. I'd like to ask a question tomorrow that I asked yesterday. What little things change your life? And let me set that back up a little bit for you so that we know what we're talking about. Yesterday, I had mentioned that we've heard the phrase, don't sweat the small stuff. But in life, the little things do make a difference. And if we think about it, if we reminisce, as we think about the future in this upcoming new year, we oftentimes will reminisce about the past. And there are people who enter our lives and leave so quickly that we barely remember them. But that encounter is important. And oftentimes, it becomes a part of you. And that's what I want to talk about tomorrow. And those examples where those brief encounters made a huge difference in your life. And some of the examples that I had mentioned yesterday were things from my childhood and as a young adult. For example, Walter Pierce. And he was only 10 years old. He was a talented baseball player in Ludlow, Vermont, who I have not seen since, but he could pitch a baseball with either arm with equal velocity and equal accuracy. He had a gift, and that gift was he had a true understanding of the game, and he was only 10 years old. He lived in a small apartment with his mother, and I suspect they had little money. You don't know in those days. Even though I would think I was about eight, I was definitely several years younger than he, he spent hours teaching me the game. And it was through that experience I became active in sports and did other things in life where activity was important. And I only knew him for a single summer, but I haven't seen him since, and I don't know where he went, but he had a difference in my life. And then there was my Aunt Agnes, who died when I was in elementary school, but in the brief time that I knew her, she instilled in me a sense of spirituality that only became apparent to me, at least, when I grew older. And then there was the friendships. And the friendships when you're a youth, they're different. Sometimes they don't last, but what they do is teach you the art of compromise, the art of communication. There was Joey Albano and Chucky Zenowich and Jimmy Lannon who taught me the art of friendship, because we did almost everything in grade school until I moved away from Ludlow. We obviously lost touch. You do that in youth when you move on. You don't keep in touch. And I just discovered maybe 6-7 months ago that Jimmy Lannon had passed away. And when I worked as a young adult in Hardwick, Vermont for a brief period, I met a brilliant, and I mean brilliant man, and he was also so modest, and he taught me that formal education opens up doors, but an open mind is what defines intelligence. This person only went to the eighth grade because he had to work to support his family, but he was brilliant. And sometimes a formal education doesn't mean you're brilliant. It only means you've had opportunities. So there's many people that influence us in our lifetime. And these brief and sometimes chance encounters do have a lasting effect, sometimes as lasting an effect on our life history and our life journey as those relationships, as those long-term relationships that we have with either family or friends. So in this new year, just interested, tomorrow we'll open up the phone lines about those people who changed your life. Be interested in that discussion. And also, for today, I wanted to get back to a discussion that we had when Bob Kinzel, the VPR, Vermont Public Radio reporter and host, was on the show. And that was this discussion about the lack of coverage, or the lack of knowledge, I guess I would say, about what our congressional delegation is doing. Bob had explained it oftentimes, we don't know the give and take of what is going on in Washington, and we have to over-rely on what our congressional delegation says through either a staged event or a press release. Rarely is there an opportunity to get another side of the issue or problem. And let me just put this in perspective for you. Suppose for a moment that Governor Shumlin suspended his weekly press conference and the legislature took steps to limit the media's access. You can imagine what would happen. There would be outrage about that, because these events during the legislative session, just for background, during the legislative session and frequently, but perhaps less frequently, in the rest of the year, the governor faces the media at a formal press conference. And sometimes there's an announcement, but always the governor opens it up. And it doesn't matter which governor it is. They open it up to any question or any matter or any issue. It is these press conferences where Vermonters get a real sense of what is going on in Montpelier and how policy decisions are made. And it gives an important record, both audio and visual, of course, of the governor in his or her own words. And at the federal level, it is different. Vermont's congressional delegation is not held to the same standard as state officials. Rarely has a congressman or senator hosted weekly unrestricted Vermont media availabilities similar to the governor. I haven't seen it. And for Vermonters, this is unfortunate. Because here's the reason. There are monumental challenges in our nation. Let's just take what the debate was about, foreign policy, last Saturday, that few people watched if you look at the ratings, but let's just take national security as just one example. The Middle East, I don't think anybody can argue this, the Middle East is in chaos. ISIS is expanding its control and has been expanding its control. If it isn't in Syria and Iraq, they're now in Africa and Afghanistan. They are inspiring more attacks and death in Europe. Egypt is experiencing chronic political chaos, and this doesn't even bring in the issue of Israel into the equation. So regularly scheduled press conferences conducted by Vermont Press Corps would ensure that thorough questions, at least in my mind, thorough questions are asked and answers are provided about these national security issues are very complex. And getting to the root of it is not through a press release or a staged event. Getting to the root of it is asking questions and having our congressional delegation answer those questions. Look, I get why politicians don't like this format. I get it. Because politicians want to be at a forum where they control the outcome. And that is, so they want to manage the issue for the purpose of re-election or election to an office. And when journalists cover a range of topics, the discussion always goes well beyond what the scripted speeches or the press releases say. That's why media coverage of members of Congress is usually a staged event, and carefully staged for that matter. And even most media interviews are limited in subject matter and time. I remember that Senator Bernie Sanders at one time walked out of an interview with Stuart Ledbetter primarily because it wasn't on the subject matter that the senator wanted to talk about. So none of this is really, these staged events, they're not a substitute for the real 60-minute press conference that the governor does almost weekly. And that's unfortunate because this format allows ample opportunity to delve deep into the issues and satisfy the need of critical information that is often gleaned not from the initial question but from the follow-up questions. And we often hear from our congressional delegation that scheduling conflicts or work in Washington, that it just prevents them from having the availability to the press. But governor schedules, look at the governor's schedules. They're no less demanding. In fact, I would argue they're probably more demanding, and yet they find time each week. So nowadays, even if you were busy, there's technology that you can make yourself available, whether you're in Vermont or in D.C. So from my perspective, the more that our elected leaders face tough questioning from reporters, the better informed we will be. And if our three members of Congress each held a regularly scheduled press conference with the Vermont media, similar to what the governor does, I think Vermonters would be better served for that. Be very interested in your opinions on what we should be doing, how we should be covering our Vermont congressional delegation. If you have an opinion, give me a call at WDEV. And the number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Just a reminder, tomorrow, be very important on your phone calls. We'll be setting up those little things in life that have changed your life, that have made a real difference in your life. And there's these long-standing relationships, but are also these brief, sometimes chance encounters that really make a difference. And I guess if we're headlining anything for tomorrow, the title would be, in life, it's the little things that can make a difference. So we're talking about congressional access and press conferences. If you have an opinion on that, give us a call at our WDEV studios, 802-244-1777, or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Dick in St. Albans. Good morning, Dick. You're on open mic.
Hi, good morning. I'm surprised that more people haven't called in. Our problem is the media. The media never asks the right questions. And we have found that these legislative breakfasts here that we have up in Franklin County. It's the general population that asked our politicians the questions and not the media. In this state, the media has basically been hand-in-hand with all the politicians here for about 20 years, and maybe the possibility of the condition of this state is because the right questions have never been asked, and there's never been any follow-up to get anything done about the problems.
But Dick, let me just challenge you a little bit on that. Let's take Vermont Health Connect, for example. It was the media that started hammering away at Governor Shumlin when he called it a nothing burger. It was the media that found out that it was a something burger.
The general population knew this. It wasn't the media that can take credit for all this. The general population was well-versed on what was going on here. I listened to some of your beginning of the show talking about setting the stage and the media setting the stage. Well, basically, I've been listening to some of the things you've been saying, and you've been pretty much setting the stage as to what type of content you want on your show. If you're going to have an open policy, the public out here shouldn't be steered in one direction or the other direction based on what the talk show host wants.
Okay, Dick. That's fair. I mean, here's what you can do. The one thing you can do is you can call in on any subject. I don't care. When I open the mic, you can call in on any subject there is. I do like to talk about things that I'm interested in. And if you're interested in those, join in. You're welcome to join the conversation. If you're not interested in that, that's certainly fine as well. This is open mic. You have the opportunity to talk about what you want. Now, will I agree all the time on what you say? Certainly not. But you have the opportunity to come in and talk about things. I think I have said that I will be cordial to anyone, whether I agree or disagree with them. I think that's important. But you have the opportunity to call in and say what you want. I bring up issues that are important to me, that I think are interesting. And if you don't agree, call in. That's what the show is all about. If you have an opinion, call in at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Tom, I love the music, so I let it go for a little while here. I'd like to welcome to our Radio Vermont studios, Matt Cota from the Vermont Fuel Dealers Association. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Matt, what does the Vermont Fuel Dealers Association do?
Sure. VFDA, Vermont Fuel Dealers Association, originally formed as the Vermont Oil Heat Institute back in 1963. We're a nonprofit trade association, a 501c6, and one of our main missions is to provide information for our members regarding regulatory issues of their concern to them. We provide education and training programs for the thousands of heating technicians in the state. They have to maintain their licensing and certification. We provide that training for our member companies. We also do a lot of work in the State House, even though we are sometimes called an unregulated fuel, talking about heating oil and propane and gasoline and diesel fuel. We are, in fact, one of the most regulated, unregulated fuels out there, especially here in Vermont.
So who your members are those fuel dealers who deliver oil and or propane to your house, gas stations?
Right. We're the last stop. So we're the fuel companies that deliver heating oil to your house, the propane companies that deliver propane to your house, other types of what they're called as jobbers or fuel companies, delivery companies, retailers who are interacting with the Vermont consumers. They don't own a refinery. They're not wholesalers. They don't own a stake in the Bakken in North Dakota or in the Eagle Ford in Texas. These are retailers that are delivering BTUs door-to-door. In fact, many of these companies started 100 years ago delivering coal and ice to their customers here in Vermont. Of course, we became electrified, and we had no longer needed ice chests because we all got Frigidaires. And eventually, people scaled off of coal and went to heating oil. And that's where we are today, where our members provide 8 out of every 10 homes are receiving a fuel delivered by one of our member companies.
You have been an opponent of the carbon tax, but proponents argue that a carbon tax would improve Vermont's economy while cutting its carbon emissions. What's your beef with the carbon tax?
Well, that's a great question, a pretty wide-ranging question, if you allow me to sort of address the issue from 30,000 feet.
You can go for the next 25 minutes.
Well, I don't want to bore your listeners, but no, there is a fascinating topic, and as we head into the holiday season, it's one of those that really generates conversation around the dinner table when you have your friends and family coming in from all over talking about the different issues that they're dealing with here in Vermont. And one of the issues that we've experienced over the past year now and will likely deal with in legislative session is whether or not to impose a fee or a tax on all fuel that is consumed here in Vermont. This is the carbon tax, the carbon pollution tax, as it calls. There's two pieces of legislation that have been drafted that did not receive any formal votes last year, but because it's the second year of the biennium, will be heard again. A carbon tax essentially assesses a fee for any fuel that is consumed in Vermont that is paid for by the retailer. Those are the companies that deliver it to you or deliver it to the gas stations where you fill it up with your car. The main problem with the carbon tax is the carbon tax lobby likes to say this will reduce carbon emissions while improving the economy, and after all, the big oil companies are going to pay for it. Well, that's just simply not true. ExxonMobil, BP, they're not writing a check to the state of Vermont. This is a $600 million tax when it goes up to $100 per metric ton on the citizens of Vermont. Anyone that drives to work, anyone that powers their vehicle, heats their home, will pay this tax. The problem that we have is that it's being proposed as a revenue neutral idea, that we are going to tax the things that we don't like and we are going to refund consumers for their costs. Well, then you don't get at what the core of a carbon tax is. As any economist will tell you, a carbon tax is meant to inflict pain to enforce you to use less. Carbon is being described as a sin that we need to create a sin tax to eliminate its use. Well, the fundamental problem with that is that we need fuels that do have carbon intensity. We need them for a lot of reasons. We need them to stay warm in the winter in our cold state. We need it to get to work in our very rural state. We need diesel fuel for power our school buses to get our kids to school. We need diesel fuel. All the towns buy a lot of diesel fuel to keep the roads clear in the wintertime. We need gasoline to get consumers here so they spend money at our ski areas. The idea that we are punishing something that's bad and we're trying to eliminate it truly negates the fact that over the past 100 years, the quality of life in Vermont has improved substantially because of our access to reliable, clean, and efficient and affordable energy, such as gasoline, diesel fuel, propane, and heating oil.
Is this a real possibility that this will pass this year, given I had Speaker Smith in here the other day? I've had many of the gubernatorial candidates, and they say they oppose this tax. I think they use the phrase this year. So is there any possibility that this will raise its head in the legislative session this year?
Well, certainly I've talked to the people in power, as my job, to find out what the status is and where it's going, and it's no surprise, you can read it in the papers as well, that everyone that has a position to influence or move this bill has said it will not move in 2016. We are not going to vote on a legislation that would put 88 cents a gallon on gasoline, that would put $1 a gallon on heating oil. We are not going to pass a piece of legislation that does that in 2016, which is, of course, an election year. And that's the big rub. You know, the proponents of a carbon tax understand that this is a multi-year effort, but they're dedicated and they're going door to door, and they believe that with the right convincing, Vermonters will go it alone and pass this punitive tax that will, quite frankly, hurt those least among us that can't afford it, that have to drive long distances to get to work, to get to a job because they live in a rural community. They'll hurt those that live along the border, and many of those border towns are struggling. As a kid who grew up in Bells Falls, Vermont, I can tell you the last thing we need is to make New Hampshire look more attractive for businesses and for consumers. But there's a strong feeling that we need to do whatever we can in order to reduce carbon consumption in Vermont, even if it sacrifices our rural communities, in our border towns, of which 7 out of 14 counties, border Massachusetts, New York, or New Hampshire, that's about half our population, the real fact is that once you increase the cost of a commodity by 50% in one state, people will go to the other state in order to purchase it.
We're speaking with Matt Cotto, who is with the Vermont Fuel Dealers Association. If you wish to join our conversation, give us a call at our WDEV studios at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Bill in Berrytown. Bill, you're on open mic.
Oh, good morning. I was listening to you, and I'm trying to find a way. The benefits of this tax versus the harm of this tax, and you have mentioned what it's going to do, who it's going to hurt. I completely agree. It's going to hurt poor. I'm retired, but it's still going to hurt people like us because right now, after we bought all our Christmas presents, our cars, we have two. My wife has one. I have one. And they're both half full of oil or gas, and we have to wait till next year till we get paid in order to put any more gas in it. But who is it going to help? Well, let me put it this way. Here in little old Vermont, and the amount of carbon that we burn and put into the air compared to the rest of the country, and worse yet, compared to China. So here we are. It's not going to help the environment, I don't think, one bit for little old Vermont to do it. But who it's going to hurt is those people that you just mentioned who are fanatic about wanting to have this tax. It's going to make them look good. Here, Vermont is going to be the leader in producing this carbon tax that's going to, as you said, force people to pay more, hurt, punish people for buying gasoline that they need. So, that's the whole key. It's not going to really help anybody in the way of helping reduce carbon. It's just going to help make some people look good.
Bill brings up a really good question here, and it's one that I've asked several of the candidates and Speaker Smith the other day, is that Vermont has one of the smallest, if not the smallest, carbon footprint in the United States. And what would implementing this tax do in terms of the overall carbon footprint if we don't do this in conjunction with other states? I mean, it seems to have a disproportional impact on Vermonters for the gain that I'm suspect whether it will have the gain that most people think it will have.
Yeah, well, Bill brings up an excellent point. And, you know, we talk about who's a winner or a loser in this system. And clearly people that need to drive long distances to work, people that need to heat their homes are losers. People that live along the border are losers. In terms of the environment, you know, we're 50th out of 50 in terms of the U.S. in terms of carbon pollution. We are 50th out of 50 in fossil fuel consumption here in Vermont. So we clearly are not the ones that are causing any problems. We are clearly not the ones that are going to change the global temperature. And it does have something to do with, you know, being the leader in the clubhouse. But, you know, to sacrifice our future so a few people can claim that they were first does not seem like a prudent choice. But there are winners in this. There's no question. It won't be Bill and others that may have to wait until April 15th in order to get a check back from the government for $211 that will account for, you know, all the money that they've spent in the dollar per gallon tax over the past year. That's the revenue neutral part of it. But there's two bills before the legislature, right? One of them takes a 10% skim off the top. The other one takes a 20% skim. It creates a new bureaucracy, the state of Vermont. So 20% of that $600 million, or 10%, depending on which bill passes, if they do pass and are signed into law, would take money to create a new bureaucracy that would dole out the money to, surprise, the very same people who are supporting this legislation in the form of incentives, rebates, and credits for alternative energy developments.
Let's go to Jerry in Callis. Jerry, you're on open mic.
Hello?
Hello, you're on.
Yeah. I have to agree with the gentleman that is talking about this carbon tax because it would hit me bad, and all the people that I know that depend on heating oil, gas to get to work, and what have you. I think And like Bill said, you know, we're not going to stop pollution all by ourselves because there are so many countries that, especially China, all of that comes from the Pacific across into California and right straight through the whole nation before it cleans itself out. And it, I mean, you need to get on to these countries that are doing the pollution and stop that first, and then, you know. But a carbon tax would kill me. I just can't. There's no way that I can, you know, afford alternative energy of any sort because I live in a very cold valley. There's no sun that comes in, so solar power is out. And wind power is out, and everything is out for me, and I couldn't afford it anyway. And there's a lot of people right here in this town of Calais that are in the same boat as I am, and I don't think that's fair to put on such an expensive tax at any time. And I just, you know, hope that legislature comes into have some common sense on this. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thanks, Jerry. What do you say, Matt?
Well, you know, one of the things that that the carbon tax lobby has said, I don't know if they're listening to the show or going to call in, but also I'll give them a little plug. You know, one of the things they said is, listen, we want to be revenue neutral. You know, that's their goal. We want to base it off of an existing law that is in British Columbia, where there is a carbon tax, and we want to be revenue neutral. But that's not what's been proposed. You know, the idea of what's happening in British Columbia, there is a carbon tax. It is $30 per metric ton. In Vermont, the high end is $100 per metric ton, so, you know, it's a lot smaller. Number one is in British Columbia, they return to the taxpayers, and over the past 6 years, they've collected $5 billion in carbon taxes and returned to the taxpayers about $5.2 billion. In other words, for every dollar that's spent in a carbon tax, the government has returned $1.14 to the citizens. It's more than revenue neutral. And how can they afford to do that? How can the British Columbia government afford to do that? Well, they can do that because they're the second largest natural gas producer in all of Canada. So they have helped their bottom line. They can do that because half their population of 4.5 million people live in the city of Vancouver, where they have public transportation. They can do that because they're bordered by the Northern Rocky Mountains, the Pacific Ocean, and a 1,200-long-mile international border with the United States. Here, so any comparison to say, well, they do it in British Columbia, why can't we do it here? Well, those are we're fundamentally different. We may be cold weather areas, but we are fundamentally different in geography. We're fundamentally different in population. I mean, we share school districts with the state of New Hampshire. I grew up in Bellows Falls. We used to have a grocery store. We used to have a men's clothing store. We used to have a sports store. We don't anymore. Why? Because of the tax policies that we have in Vermont and what they have in New Hampshire, and it's driven all of that activity over the border. Right now, we have gas stations that are going under along the Connecticut River because of an 8-cent differential between the New Hampshire gas tax and the Vermont gas tax. Imagine what it's going to be when it's 88 cents plus 8. When we're looking at a dollar per gallon differential from just crossing that skinny little river, we are going to wear out our bridges going to New Hampshire because everyone's going to be going there to buy their fuel. Meanwhile, we won't have any money in Montpelier to fix the roads because it's all going to Concord. Because not only will they not collect the carbon tax here, they won't be collecting the excise tax.
What would you do to reduce carbon emissions?
That's a great question. And one of the things that I would do is first recognize what's working currently. We don't have a big government program like we have for electricity for reducing carbon emissions for gasoline, diesel fuel, heating oil. Yet, in fact, we are seeing significant reductions because of the unregulated efficiency marketplace. We're seeing a 10% reduction in gasoline consumption here in Vermont. Many of the reasons are because we are driving more fuel-efficient cars. We're seeing significant reductions in heating oil. We've dropped 34% just in the past 10 years of heating oil. Why? Well, think of a car that you would drive from 20, 30 years ago. If you're replacing your boiler from 15, 20 years ago, you're getting even if it's just a basic model, you're getting a much more efficient boiler or furnace. We know more about building science than we did before in terms of insulation, doors, and windows. So in 1974, where the average Vermont home consumed over 1,500 gallons of heating oil per home, now we're less than 700 gallons. Many homes were less than 600 gallons, and we know this because we're selling the fuel. And we're seeing our volumes drop precipitously. So in other words, Vermonters don't need to be told by a government to use less. They don't need to be taxed and told in order to spend how to spend their money. What they need to do is, what the government needs to do is recognize what's happening in the marketplace already, to encourage that, and to leave it alone. Because we are as a state, we are doing many things to reduce our carbon pollution, taxing it and sacrificing our economic future in order to speed that process up is not a good idea.
The proponents of the carbon tax said, basically are saying, and I'm using my words, not theirs, that if we don't show leadership, then who will? And that's one of the premises that I get from reading the material, is that we need to show leadership in doing this. What's your response to that?
We can't sacrifice our future just so the carbon tax lobby can go to their cocktail parties in Washington, D.C. and say that they've shown leadership. We need to think about what's in the best interest of Vermont. And I would hope that the people of Vermont and their representatives in Montpelier recognize that this is not about showing off. This is about doing what's right for Vermont and for our future.
Let's go to the phone line and Ron in Essex. Ron, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning. I haven't heard the point brought up of what this will do to the price of all goods and services in this state that, you know, they have to use gas to get them delivered.
Certainly. Those tractor-trailer trucks, they use diesel fuel, and at $100 per metric ton, that's $1 to $2 a gallon. But let's not forget the farmers. The farmers use some 6 million gallons of dyed diesel every year. Well, that's $1 to $2 a gallon. That's you're asking our struggling Vermont dairy farmers to cough up $6 million in a carbon tax so they'll use the less of their tractors. Why? We need to power our agricultural economy. This is a positive for our economy, and yet we want to penalize them for using their tractors. Trains that reduce gasoline consumptions, they use 10 million gallons of diesel fuel here in Vermont every year. Well, that's another $10 million that they're having to raise their rates and their fees. Construction, off-road vehicles, you know, they use 15 million gallons every year in Vermont to build our roads and bridges and to log our forests. You know, they'll be paying $1 a gallon under $100 per metric ton as prescribed in the bill. Think about the commercial use of diesel fuel and heating oil for manufacturing, for heating large businesses. If you were a business in Vermont right now and you were thinking about expanding, or you were thinking about moving to New Hampshire or New York or Massachusetts or somewhere else, and you were looking at the prospect of your energy costs increasing by 50% forever, why? Why would you think about expanding here? If you were thinking about relocating here and you were thinking and you're looking at the prospect of an energy tax, a carbon tax that would increase the cost of the diesel for your delivery trucks, that would increase the cost of gasoline for your service vehicles, that would increase the cost of the heat or the process fuels, and looking at that going up 50% in relation to other states, why would you choose Vermont? How much damage has this idea that this legislation that these 28 lawmakers have sponsored, how much damage have we already done to Vermont's economy without even enacting anything?
We'll continue our conversation with Matt Cota from the Vermont Fuel Dealers Association in a moment. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're speaking with Matt Cota, who's joining us in our Radio Vermont studios here. Matt is with the Vermont Fuel Dealers Association, and we're talking about carbon tax. If you wish to join the conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to the phone line and Bob from Plainfield. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning, gentlemen. Just a quick question. Is a carbon tax really about saving the environment, or is it just another tax and revenue stream for Montpelier?
There you go.
Bob, that's a great question. You know, one of the things that you're concerned about when you create a carbon tax is you create a revenue stream that, of course, can always be raised because you're creating a new tax, but you're also creating an easy out There's some tough decisions, as you know, Mike, right before the legislature about what to do about the budget, what programs to cut, and it's not a fun job. It is a hard job. And to be able to get out there with a red pen and figure out what you need and what you don't need is difficult, and I recognize that. But if there is a ever-flowing source of income coming from the carbon tax that you can backfill any budget gaps that you have, and then whatever's left over at the end of the day, then you put towards a rebate for low-income people that have had to pay a higher price for the carbon tax. Well, trust the government is what they're trying to say. Trust us. We'll do the right thing for your money. But the reality is we're giving them $600 million for them to spend, and there's no stipulations that it be spent in certain ways. We could very easily see that money going back to the government programs and the government growing and growing. We're already creating a new bureaucracy, well, again, depending on what bill, it's either a 10% skim or a 20% skim that would fund this this board that's going to dole out incentives to some of the people that have sponsored the bill and are supporting it. So, you know, I think Vermonters in general are distrustful of creating a new bureaucracy, creating a new tax that could keep expanding the size and scope of government.
Besides the carbon tax, what other legislative priorities do you have?
You know, Vermont Fuel Dealers Association, we're a nonprofit trade association. We're very similar to other trade associations that work with the business community. We're interested in policies that would increase the amount of economic activity in the state of Vermont. We're interested in goals and ideals that will increase productivity from businesses, that will encourage other businesses to locate, encourage people to visit to Vermont, to spend their money here in Vermont. We want more homes to serve for our efficiency and our fuels. We want more cars coming through here so that they're going to spend money at our restaurants and ski areas so we can help fuel their cars. Our interests are aligned with most of the business community in adopting policies and protocols that will ensure that Vermont is a great place to do business, is a great place to visit.
Anything that you're guarding against?
Sure. I mean, we are very concerned with opportunities that the legislature sees to increase the cost of the fuels that we sell. We're very concerned about not only the carbon tax, but other taxes being proposed that would increase the fuel costs and then create and expand government in other ways.
Let's go to the phone lines. Let's go to Max in Hyde Park. Max, I've got a very, very short amount of time here, so if you can get your question in, I'd appreciate it.
More of a statement, Mike. I think that the problem with carbon this whole thing can be solved with nuclear power plants and family planning. And it's frustrating to me that we don't talk about that more. We don't need a carbon tax. We need nuclear power. Thank you.
Thanks, Max. Any response?
Well, I don't know about family planning, but I can tell you about power. And, you know, there's two different philosophies. One is that, you know, that we can simply deliver all of our heat and all of our power for our cars through lines, through electric lines. And yes, there is a movement to do that, whether it's from wind or solar or hydro or nuclear power or natural gas power plants. But the reality is, in this rural state, in this cold rural state, we are going to need deliverable liquid fuels, not just now, but for the long-term future. You know, it is deliverable liquid fuels that powered the backhoes and the trucks and powered the cell phone tower generators when the power went down during Irene. You know, it's the fuel that our member companies provide that help keep Vermont's economy moving.
If people wanted to find out more about the carbon tax from your perspective or to find out more about your organization, where would they go?
Sure, they should go to vermontfuel.com, spell it out, VermontFuel.com. There they can see our homepage. They can learn about our low-sulfur fuel that we sell. They can learn about our member companies that provide fuel and efficiency services all across Vermont. And they can also click on the link that takes them to the page that shows you what the carbon tax is and who supports it in the legislature.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you for your time.
I appreciate it, Mike.
We've been speaking with Matt Cota from the Vermont Fuel Dealers Association. We've been talking about the carbon tax. If you have any questions, go to the website that Matt talked about. Go to the phone number that Matt talked about. And then make your own judgment in terms of what your position is on the carbon tax. Many callers called in opposed to a carbon tax. Coming up, a conversation with our colleagues in Washington, D.C. of Talk Media News Service. And also, former Governor Jim Douglas will join us in studio. And we'll be talking about what goes on this time of year on the fifth floor in the governor's office. It's a very busy time. And, of course, if you miss any portion of this show, you can go on the WDEVradio.com website and click on the podcast icon. This is Open Mic on WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury, Vermont, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and 101.9 FM from Island Pond. And, of course, as I just said, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Coming up, a conversation with our colleagues in Washington, D.C. at Talk Media News. And then former Governor Jim Douglas will be in studio with us. We'll be talking about the busy time of year on the fifth floor in the governor's office this time of year, with speeches that need to be done and need to be written, with the budget that needs to be presented, and with a legislative agenda that needs to be put together and ready as the legislature returns. But let's head down to our colleagues in Washington, D.C. at Talk Media News. And Bob, good morning.
How are you doing?
Good. This is Bob Ney.
Yes, and Alan's with you tomorrow.
Oh, great. Hey, anything going on down there today? It's probably pretty quiet, isn't it?
Well, right. You know, it is quiet. Now, remember, it's the in-district work period, not the recess or break. But we do have stories we're carrying today. It continued about Trump and Hillary, but also a bit of a story, because there are some things going on, although it's, you know, almost Christmas, about the visa application of the two terrorist killers. You know, that's in there. And Iraq, which is kind of an interesting story about the Iraqi forces going into Ramadi to take it back, and also the governor of Kentucky changing the marriage license to help Miss Davis and her religious beliefs. So those are the stories, if you're interested in any.
I am.
There.
Let's talk Ramadi first. Ramadi, yes, of course, is the city that was hard fought by U.S. troops to win, and then was taken back by ISIS in a rout, basically, of the Iraqi forces. They've been at it for months trying to get that city back, haven't they, Bob?
Yes, they have, and this is really an important story that goes a little bit deeper than, you know, I think what we're reading here. But the Iraqi troops and the allied tribesmen, and that's kind of important, these tribes that are out there, the nomadic tribes that aren't loyal to anybody, you know, Sunni or Shiite, they're backed by, and this is a report coming out of D.C., by U.S.-led airstrikes, because we do some airstrikes and you go on the ground. They're advancing in the center of Ramadi, and, of course, when we were there, as you said, fought so hard. But they're fighting the militants street to street, and they're heading for the main government complex, and they want to take that back. And because ISIS has been rounding people up, they're going to use them as human shields, so this is really going to be, you know, a really tough fight. But I mention this because originally, when we went into Iraq, we made a horrific mistake of disbanding 400,000 military and police and saying, you are Baathist Saddam Hussein people, go away. And of course they went away, so we completely disbanded everything, tried to recreate that over a period of a decade, basically kind of failed at that, because as you remember, the troops were taking their military clothes off and having street clothes underneath and running away from ISIS. I mean, we all know about that. So yes, we've done airstrikes. And yes, the tribesmen are aligned with the Iraqis, but I must point out the missing piece to this story, in my opinion, the Iranians. The Iranians have been the fabric that have held the Iraqis back together.
You know what was interesting with me, Bob, was that, and I lost a lot of respect for him when he said this, was General Dempsey said when Ramadi fell, basically he said, no big deal. And that set off a firestorm. It set off a firestorm in the community that I once belonged to, which was SEAL Team, but it sent off a firestorm throughout the U.S. military, and it was a big deal. I mean, that was hard fought to get that city back.
Ramadi was a big deal. Mosul, I mean, you know the scope of this, and the special forces, the SEAL teams. I mean, everybody our American military, period, put in, amazing bravery to get, you know, Iraq to where it got to. And, of course, within Iraq, there wasn't the will, frankly, of the military internally to, you know, to correspond. And then the Iranians came in and beefed it up, and we've done our airstrikes and things like that. I also kind of wanted to point out a cultural point when I went to Baghdad myself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was told by our American military who were there, they said, look, when Saddam was here and told people to pick up their rifles and go after, you know, the Iranians when they fought their war against Iran, he said the first guy that didn't do it, they knelt him down and they put a bullet in the back of his brain in front of everybody and said, who's next? And everybody picked up their rifles. So, you know, it was done a little bit different technique, should I say, you know, than we do. And so they're kind of... They did focus groups over there, and the Iraqis responded to authority. I mean, it's just, I'm just pointing that out because it's a whole different culture. It's not our version of democracy.
Let's switch to the two killers out in California and their visa issues. Can you sort of explain what's going on here?
Yes, and I want to mention this because it's a story that's carried a little bit. Secretary of State Kerry wrote a letter to the Iranians, particularly Javid Zarif, the minister that he did the Iran deal with. And in there he explains about not getting in the way of the deal with the visa waiver program. To defend him for a second, he's talking about certain business aspects, and also there's a problem with Iranian Americans who are American but hold dual passports of actually having a problem now to go to Europe. Now, I go into all this, and it's kind of technical, but I'm tying this to your question about the fiancé visa, and I know I'm not making sense, but here's what the Congress did. You have a woman that went from Pakistan to Saudi Arabia. She meets this, you know, an American that runs over there, and he meets her at Mecca, and they get married, and they go through the visa application process, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now this is all being questioned. Was it thoroughly vetted? So the Congress does a visa waiver program and comes out and says, uh-huh, if you have been in Iran in the last 5 years, or the Sudan, or Syria and Iraq, we're really going to look at you. They did it in response to California. Those two lunatics went from Pakistan to Saudi Arabia to America. So why are we focusing on if you've been in Iran?
That's right.
I want to point that out first. The Congress did nothing of the two that came from Saudi Arabia to here. So now they're looking into the whole process of fiancé visas. And they're taking the Republicans, Mr. Goodlatte is saying, well, my goodness, you know, that should have raised a red flag when they asked her, have you ever been involved with militant groups or gun running? And she said, no, that should have raised a flag. Why? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, if you and I are gun runners, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we go to the American Embassy and they say, have you guys run guns? And we're going to go, oh, yes, yes, we have, yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure.
They're
barking up the wrong tree.
You can't make this stuff up.
And that's what I wanted to kind of, in my humble opinion, point out, having been in Congress, too.
Hey, Bob, Merry Christmas to you and
Merry
your family.
Merry Christmas.
Thank you so much.
All right.
We've been speaking with Bob Ney from Talk Media News. Up next, former Governor Jim Douglas. We'll talk to him about issues going on in Vermont. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. In studio with us in our Radio Vermont studio this morning is former Governor Jim Douglas. Good morning, Governor.
Well, great to be here, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for coming. Yesterday, we had talked with Liz Miller, who is the former chief of staff to Governor Shumlin. And one of the things that we talked about is, not a lot of people know this, but this time of year is particularly busy in the governor's office. You have two speeches, a budget, a legislative agenda. Could you walk us through sort of your memory of that and what went on during this period of time?
It certainly is a busy time, Mike. I recall the first legislative session I dealt with in 2003, after only 2 months to get ready following the election. So that was quite hectic. And I thought, well, in future years, we ought to be a little more rational about preparing for the legislative session. We ought to start earlier and not have such a crunch toward the end. And to some extent, we did. In the summer, I would, through the Secretary of Administration, send out budget targets to all the agencies so they'd have a little time to think about their budget preparation process. I'd ask agencies and departments for legislative initiatives that they would like to offer, and I'd have an opportunity through the late summer and early fall to look at those and decide which I liked and which I didn't. And, of course, I'd have my own ideas and work with the agencies to prepare those legislative packages, too. There ought to be enough time. The problem is the sands are always shifting. New economic information comes in. Revenues are generally determined by the emergency board in July and January. But during the recession, we had more frequent e-board meetings to keep closer tabs on revenue forecasting. So budgets have to continually be adjusted. And there are, as you mentioned, two major speeches in January, the inaugural message in an odd year and the State of the State message in an even year, and a budget speech in every year. And those are opportunities for the governor to set forth his or her view of the State of the State, highlight important issues that ought to be addressed during the session. The second, the budget speech, a chance to be more fiscally focused, although I certainly took the opportunity of an audience before of legislators and the public to talk about whatever was on my mind. So it is a busy time, but it comes together.
Next year there'll be a new governor. Of course, you just mentioned that governor has about 2 months as opposed to starting in the summer in terms of putting a budget together. What did you find in that sort of hectic period was the most important things that you had to do to get ready during that transition year?
Well, first of all, I should say the Governor Dean was very helpful. He reached out even before the election to the major candidates and said there will be office space available, computers, phones, whatever you need. And the legislature appropriates a modest sum for staff for a governor-elect's office. Conveniently for me, the space assigned was upstairs from the treasurer's office, it was easy then to keep in touch with my transition staff. Staffing up is probably job one, because the agencies under the retiring governor's administration would have begun to prepare a draft budget. The new governor has the not only opportunity but responsibility to put his or her own imprint on it, but the agencies would have begun that process. So hiring folks was key, and I was able to get a lot of good people to come into state government, oftentimes at a financial disadvantage. But I remember talking with people, perhaps present company included, to say, well, you know, I've been complaining about governmental for a long time. Step up to the plate. And a lot of people did. And I felt really good about the team I had in place. So I think staffing up is job one. And, of course, the resumes just come in like a flood because people are looking for opportunities. And so sifting through them all is quite a task.
Going back to the speeches, of course, you have the budget that's being worked along in a transition year that's at an accelerated pace during a regular year. It starts in August, as you said, but the speeches start, November, December,
yeah.
That area. What did you... Can you explain the process?
Well, I'd say to my communications director, principally chief of staff, here are the major topics that need to be covered in the upcoming speech. Go draft some sections, talk to the relevant agencies. If I have a major part on health care or Medicaid, for example, talk to the agency people responsible for that and get the right framework of a section of the speech. And we'd have a number of meetings. I suppose it's somewhat speech by committee, at least for a while. But in the end, it has to be my voice. And so there's a lot of refinement. I'd take drafts home. I'd read them through, silently, and make changes and adjustments, and then I would have an oral run through as well, just to make sure that I got the right emphasis and paused at the right times, because this is an important time when the state is watching. And I think the text has to be good too, Mike, because these speeches are recorded in the legislative journals. When Dick Snelling was inaugurated the first time in 1977, he literally read through all the inaugural addresses of his predecessors, all 70-some odd of them, and I just wanted to get a feel for the flow of history. So they are something that people read throughout the course of time.
When would your final version be finalized?
When I was at the podium? Well, maybe a little before then, but there used to be a practice where the governor would distribute a copy of the text of the speech to all legislators, and I didn't like that. First of all, from a practical matter, as you're suggesting, there might be last-minute changes, and secondly, the spectacle of lawmakers sitting there flipping through papers, listening maybe, but following along, just wasn't the right image, I thought. I mean, to see people fumbling with papers throughout the speech when they ought to be listening. So I decided we'll give them copies of the speech afterward for both of those reasons. So there are refinements right up until the end. And, of course, I wanted to make sure everything I said was accurate. There could be differences of opinion, and certainly were, but we did a lot of fact-checking right up until the end as well.
Any last-minute surprises or any surprises during the process?
No, I'd been around a long time, as you had. I was on the governor's staff. I'd been in the state house in different roles, so I kind of knew the drill. Once I was interrupted by anti-war protesters, and I can't remember if it was my last year or next to last year, but I remember Dick Snelling was interrupted once, and I learned from his experience, because he tried to shout him down, and you really can't. So I just stopped where I was in the speech. Step back a few steps and let the president of the Senate, Brian Doobie, who was presiding over the Joint Assembly, bring the House to order, and the sergeant-at-arms escorted the demonstrators out, and with a fairly brief interruption, I went back and continued.
You talked about staffing and how important that is for an incoming governor. Anything else that an incoming governor should be aware of in terms of this? Because we will have a new governor this new year coming up. And one of the things that, other than sort of the staffing, and that is critically important, what else advice would you give to that governor?
Well, staff and budget, I thought, were the key issues within those first 2 months of a transition period. Other logistical matters, making contacts with the National Governors Association, for example, responding to requests for interviews from the media. There was an awful lot of that, and I had to fit that in with my continuing duties as state treasurer as I was wrapping up that assignment, and other requests from interest groups and organizations that wanted some of the governor's time. And there was a kind of a natural transition. I experienced it myself 8 years later. Folks started inviting Governor Dean less and the governor-elect more. And then when I began to leave, that happened too during the final couple of months. There weren't as many requests because people were focused on the new guy. So there are a lot of demands on the governor's time. And interestingly, Mike, after an election, a lot of newly elected governors go on vacation. And what I said to the team is, look, we've got a limited number of days here. We've got these personnel decisions to make. We've got a budget to begin to frame up and get ready for presentation in late January. We've got the inaugural address. Let's just work right now, and if there's time around the holidays, then I might take a few days off, which is what I did. But on election night in November of 2002, I announced that we were having a staff meeting at 9 o'clock the next morning.
I remember it well. Let's go to the phone lines, and let's go to Fred in Moncton Ridge. Fred, you're on Open Mic with Jim Douglas.
Good Good morning, Governor.
Morning.
You are a proud Republican, been one most of your life. Can you comment on the dog and pony show that is the Republican Party right now with the race that's going on and with the candidates? Let's hear a little bit of a local guy's opinion on a national deal. Thank you.
Well, it's intriguing, to say the least. I wouldn't have anticipated that the Republican nominating process would be where it is today. There are often some candidates who are out of the ordinary, but whose fortunes generally fade early in the process. So I have to confess to some surprise that a couple of candidates without government experience are still doing well. It may be because the field hasn't narrowed yet. Senator Graham just dropped out. Governor Jindal did recently. And maybe as others do, and the number of people on the debate stage is less, that we'll see some other more traditional candidates emerge. That would be my hope, frankly, because we need to field a credible, strong, experienced candidate who can go up against the presumed Democratic nominee.
Thanks, Fred. Just briefly on presidential politics, have you come out in support of anybody?
I have not, not for lack of invitations. There were a number of colleagues who were in the race. I served with Governor Jindal, Governor Pataki, Governor Huckabee, Governor Bush, and I think there was another one.
Christie?
Yes, thank you, Mike. and Governor O'Malley too, but so I know these folks. They're all good guys. They're different, but I haven't formally endorsed anybody yet.
We're speaking with former Governor Jim Douglas. We'll be back in a moment with your calls. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're speaking with former Governor Jim Douglas. If you wish to join our conversation, the number to call in is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Again, call in at our WDEV studios at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Governor, let's turn to some issues that are current here in Vermont. We just had Matt Cota from the Fuel Dealers Association, the Vermont Fuel Dealers Association, and he was opposed to a carbon tax. What's your opinion on a carbon tax?
Well, I thought Matt was very articulate. I heard his interview on the radio in the car, and I agree completely. This would be a big windfall to the renewable industrial complex that would go to developers to put up more wind machines on our ridge lines and more hardware on our farmlands. But I don't see the advantage to Vermont, and I see a lot of disadvantages. As Matt noted, we're last in the nation in terms of our carbon emissions. We're the only state, I believe, that is a net carbon sink. Our heavily forested state absorbs more carbon than we emit because we've been such good environmental stewards through the years. We don't have the smokestacks that other places do, the emissions from municipal treatment plants and that sort of thing. We've dealt with all of that, so we don't have the need. In fact, we're the only state that's exempt from the new EPA emission rule because we don't have a problem here. Now, I don't want to ignore the fact that we still have emissions from motor vehicles and ought to continue to work to reduce them. We've taken some steps with more support for public transit, with bike paths and carpooling. When we were in office, we built more of those park and ride facilities, and we're doing what we can. But this is a rural state where people are going to have to use their cars to get to work, and we have to recognize that and not put Vermonters at a disadvantage. The other concern I have is that it would be a new revenue source. And generally, taxes, once imposed at whatever level, go up. Years ago, the income tax was 1%. Now it's 9, the top marginal rate. Sales tax was 3 when it started. Now it's 6 or 7 in some communities. Meals and rooms tax started at 3. Now it's 9 or 10. Taxes just seem, over time, to always rise. And this would be another source that could rise. And we don't need to keep, one of our former colleagues said, feeding the tiger. We need to find ways to restrain the growth of government. So I don't think imposing a new tax is the answer today.
We're speaking with former Governor Jim Douglas. If you wish to join our conversation, call in at our WDEV studios at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Richard in Morrisville. Richard, you're on open mic with Governor Douglas. Good morning. Good morning, Richard. Good morning, Richard. Well, let's go to Sam in Williston. Sam, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Governor.
Morning.
Pleasure to talk to you and an honor.
Well, thank you.
The carbon tax. My theory is I think we should do a test run on it for, say, a three-month period for January and February and maybe August. That you can sunset it, and at the highest rate that they want. And put all the people that are for that tax on a piece of paper and pin it right next to every place you're going to be paying that tax. And they might be able to circumvent that becoming an issue again through the means of the polls. Because in the long run, you're going to be fighting the three P's, the progressives, the professors and the press who all back this issue in some strange form that they think it's going to save us. Hey. What do you think about just flushing them out real quick?
Well, that's an interesting suggestion, but I'm worried about the economic impact on our state if we were to do it even for a short time. A report came out yesterday indicating that Vermont's population declined last year. People are leaving. We have net out-migration now, more people moving to other states than coming in. And just the talk of a carbon tax, just the talk of a state-run government health care scheme gets people nervous. So we have to understand the economic effects and the impact on decisions that people make. You know, Matt made another good point, Mike, in the last hour. He talked about how smart Vermonters are. They'll do what they can to retrofit their homes and make improvements to consume less fuel. And just next week, we're having a contractor come to our house to put more insulation in. Our house is, you know, 50 or not as old as we are, but 50 or so years old, and it can be tightened up. And Vermonters are making these decisions all the time. So I just think that despite the good feeling that we might intuitively have for taking a step to reduce pollution and emissions, that this would be the wrong way to go.
Thanks, Sam. Just the other day, Bruce Lispin reported that he has a net worth of approximately $51 million. Does that make a difference in an election?
I don't think so. The Clintons are very wealthy. I don't hear people talking about that, really. I think in the end, folks will look at candidates based on their experience, on their ideas, on their commitment to Vermont, and the intangibles about, do I feel comfortable with that person serving in the role? So I don't think it's a real issue.
You've come out in support of Lieutenant Governor Phil Scott. Why?
Well, I indicated to Phil long before Bruce Lispin decided to become a candidate that I would support him. I've been urging him to look at the race for some time, perhaps even years, and I'm glad that he's in. So I've been a fan. I've committed myself to Phil's candidacy long before there was a primary contest. But I think Phil is the ideal candidate right now. He's someone whom everyone likes. I hear that all across the state. His everyday jobs tour has gotten him out in the communities in ways that most people don't get around. And he's low key, which I think is is attractive to people. We don't need bombast. There's enough of that on the presidential campaign debate stage. And he listens. He's had ups and downs in his business career. He's had real life experiences that allow him to identify with the average Vermonter. So I think he's just the right person at this point in our history.
The hit on him is that he isn't specific enough on issues, and yet when I listened to his kickoff speech, I was surprised about how many specifics were in there.
Well, I think he's heard that concern, and clearly this is a different race from the ones he's run before. Lieutenant governorship is not as intense a responsibility. The campaign isn't as focused and aggressive. So he gets that. He understands that he has to offer Vermonters a platform on which they can judge his candidacy. And, yeah, I thought he was very good at the kickoff. It was great to meet his mom, to see that nice short video that was done about his life. And I think that's the message that he'll be able to get out, that he's just an average guy who's worked hard all his life and is in politics for the right reason. I remember talking with him the first time he ran in for the Senate back in 2000, I think. He said, I wasn't politically involved. I didn't care about politics. But then I realized that what happens in Montpelier affects my business. So I decided I had to get involved. So I went to his kickoff in Berlin and for the Washington County Senate seat. I think that's the first time I met Rusty DeWeese, who was there, who's become a good friend as well. Phil's just a great guy.
It is a difference running from lieutenant governor to governor or treasurer to governor. What advice would you give him about the difference in what you have to do to run for governor?
Well, first of all, work hard. I really believe that in a state where Republicans swim upstream, where the media aren't likely to give you a break, that it's important to meet as many people as you possibly can. I said at the time, if I can just shake a quarter of a million hands over the course of this campaign, I bet I'll win, because people will see that I don't have horns, you know, that I'm reasonable and intelligent. And so I think the more people Phil can meet, that will be to his advantage. Although he needs to be specific, he has to be careful, because the press will jump on any, and his opponents will jump on anything that's perceived as a misstatement. There was one bizarre allegation already that he was sexist on something, which made no sense to me. Whether well-founded or not, people will pick apart everything you say. So meet as many people as you can.
To me, that was a campaign tactic.
Well, yeah, frankly. Just be careful with what you say.
One of the things that... Let me ask you this, because going into the last of your first gubernatorial campaign, going into the last few weeks, all the polls yes. said you were going to lose, and lose big.
Yeah.
Did you ever get discouraged during that time?
Well, when that last poll came out 2 days before the election, banner headline in the Burlington Free Press said I was down by 10%. I certainly was concerned. I got on the phone with my pollster, who assured me that that was wrong. He said, we believe that this is a toss-up, literally tied at this point. He explained the methodology that the newspaper had used, how they'd done it on the cheap, frankly, and didn't have as good a sampling as our polling did. So I accepted that, but then I thought, well, what will the public reaction be? Will my supporters become discouraged? And I decided that I had to work all the harder. And I think what actually happened, Mike, was that my opponent thought he had it in the bag and didn't work as hard. So I became a strong believer in the principle that work works, and you just have to keep at it and show your supporters that you're working right up until the final minute. Fortunately, it turned out okay.
We're speaking with former Governor Jim Douglas. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. 8255. Let's go to the phone line and Fred in Newberry. Fred, you're on open mic.
Hi. I'm wondering if there's a correlation between migration and taxes. My theory is if Vermont taxes continue to increase or even stay the same, the kids are going to leave the state and then people aren't going to move into the state. So what's going to happen to the state if that happens over, say, a 5 or 10 year period of time? It looks like the state's going to run out of money.
Well, it is happening, Fred. We have, as I suggested earlier, net domestic out-migration now, which means there are more people moving from Vermont to other states than are moving in. Our population dropped last year, but it's been fairly steady because we have a minimal amount of foreign immigration that helps, not as much as we perhaps could use, and births are still outpacing deaths, although we have the second lowest birth rate in the country. So our population is stagnant. It's aging. We all see what's happening in our public schools. We have fewer kids, and that's going to be a very serious for our workforce because the number of people between the ages of 18 and 64 in Vermont is declining, and that's when people are most likely to be working. So it's already started, and I ran into an old college friend. Well, I guess I'm being redundant. Sorry. a week or two ago, who told me that he's retiring and moving to South Carolina, and he said he was at the airport in Myrtle Beach, gave his ticket to the agent at the counter, and showed he was flying to Burlington, and the agent said, "Oh, Vermont, I hear the taxes are terrible up there." And we do have a heavy burden, we're not number one in tax burden now. We were at one point a decade ago, but we're still very high, and the reputation lingers. So I think we have to understand that, and that's why I said earlier, even the talk of a dollar a gallon carbon tax on gasoline is frightening to people who might be considering moving here.
We're speaking with former Governor Jim Douglas. We'll continue our conversation with him. I neglected to say thank you to Sam for your phone call and also thank Fred for his phone call. We'll be back in a moment. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're trying to change up the music, it seems, here, and it's working. I like that intro. We're speaking with former Governor Jim Douglas, and we're talking about various topics here in Vermont. If you wish to join our conversation, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Do you miss anything about being governor?
Well, generally, no. I qualify that, Mike, because it's hard to go cold turkey from being in the mix to dealing with issues on a day-to-day basis and then all of a sudden not. I still love this state. I care about what happens here. I would certainly do some things differently from what we've seen in the recent past, but I'm comfortable with my decision because at some point you have to pass the baton and move on, and it's important to leave the stage when people are feeling good about your tenure, and it's so gratifying. I don't want to exaggerate and say every day, but I would say every week at least someone comes up to me and says, "Oh, we miss you. We wish you were still there," and then I think I left at the right time. So I miss dealing with a lot of the issues. I miss the people with whom I worked on a daily basis and whom I don't see as frequently, present company included. There's a time to move on.
Let's go to the phone lines and Bob in East Montpelier. Bob, you're on open mic with Governor Douglas.
Yeah, I just got one question. If Phil Scott gets elected, Jim Douglas had this issue because it's controlled by a House and a Democrat. You know, the House and the Senate are both controlled by Democrats. They seem to override anything Jim Douglas wanted to pass, and I'm just wondering, even if Phil Scott gets elected, I don't know, we might be in good shape, so I was just wondering on that.
Hey, Bob, thank you for the phone call.
Well, I remember those days. It's gotten a little better because the House Republican caucus is what, 54-ish, I guess.
Yeah, I don't remember the number, but they're gaining.
Yeah, they have more than a third of the House now, which is enough to sustain a gubernatorial veto. That was not the case when I was in office in the last few terms. So it shouldn't be as disadvantageous for Phil when he's elected. But I think he's the kind of guy who can work across the aisle. He feels strongly about some things. He has principles that he will not compromise, but he's so likable and has gotten along so well. He had a Democratic state senator at his kickoff, and there may be other notable Democrats who publicly support him. So I think he has such a broad appeal that that he'll do just fine.
Let's not talk about a specific candidate, but what are some of the good qualities? What are the qualities that make a good governor?
Well, I think first and foremost, honesty. People want someone in office whom they trust, they want someone who will work hard. They want someone who is dedicated to Vermont. They want someone who is accessible. I think those are key qualities. So many times, Mike, even back when I was in the legislature, folks would come up to me and say, you know, I don't agree with you on X, but I trust you. I know you'll do what you think is right. You're representing us well, so that's why I voted for you. And so I think apart from individual issues, because we all disagree on things, we can't have a candidate with whom you're 100% in sync with. I think they want those personal qualities of honesty, hard work, access, and commitment to our state.
Let's go to the phone lines and Forbes. Forbes, you're on open mic with Jim Douglas.
Good morning. How are you?
Great.
Hi, Governor.
Hi, sir.
I've got two questions, actually. One being that a third of the state at present is pretty well interested in turning Vermont into a giant playground. And the other portion is trying to earn a living. How do you get that one back on center so that we're looking at the whole picture and not a divided picture? Two, business and industry. There's a lot of animosity between business, industry, and the government, either through regulatory or taxation. How do you turn that one around?
Well, by doing less, I guess. We have a tax burden that's quite high. We have a regulatory structure in Vermont that many believe is too onerous, and that's based on their experience in other states. There are a number of companies that have expressed that to me. They say the permitting process is far faster elsewhere. CEO of a company in southern Vermont told me that he has a plant in Massachusetts, and although their regulatory requirements are no less strict, they're still more expeditious. And there are companies I know in Vermont that are not leaving, they're not picking up and moving, but they are expanding elsewhere. And that ought to be a sign to policymakers. There are folks who, as you say, want to turn Vermont into one big park. I think we need more Vermonters to insist that their legislators understand that we have to have a balance. We're environmentalists in Vermont. We care deeply about our natural resources. They are what contribute to our quality of life and our economic success. But we have to have jobs for people here, and we can have both. We've just got to get back to an appropriate balance among all those interests.
What concerns you most about the future of Vermont?
We've touched on it already, Mike, and that is demographics. We can change our tax policy. We can change other state laws over time. But if we don't have people here, if we don't have human capital, then it's going to be very difficult. It'll be a self-fulfilling prophecy where we just shrivel as a state because no one's going to find a workforce here adequate to meet his or her needs. I said that once at event a few years ago at a senior center, and some old fellow said, "Oh, we aren't going to have more kids." Well, sir, I guess I wasn't thinking of you, but we've got to we've got more people here. We've got to have more people.
Governor, thank you very much for your time, and Merry Christmas.
Well, Merry Christmas to you, Mike. Thanks for having me.
Well, I want to thank our guest today, Matt Cota from the Vermont Fuel Dealers Association, and Governor Douglas, who we just finished up with here in studio. Tomorrow is mostly your phone calls, and next week we'll have Rusty DeWeese on coming in on Tuesday. I want to thank you all. This is Open Mic on WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury, Vermont, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and 101.9 FM from Island Pond. And, of course, we're all streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. We'll talk again tomorrow. And if you're traveling, travel safe, and Merry Christmas.